This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
And we believe that time to start researching that, understanding those use cases is now, so that we can start to guide potentially, whether they're operating system level, at an application level, at a service level, what those engagements might be. And also the individual's perspective on that, their levels of trust and safety.
Hello and welcome to This Is HCD. My name is Jerry Scullion and I'm a designer, educator and the host of This Is HCD based in the wonderful city of Dublin, Ireland. In this episode, I caught up with Oliver Wiedlich of Contextual in Sydney, formerly known as Mobile Experience. Now, I've met Oliver several times over the years whilst I was living in Sydney, and always in passing though, and never really in detail, but was always hugely impressed whenever I saw him speak about design and user experience in particular. And here is no different. We focus our conversation on spatial computing and get straight into the nitty-gritty of what this is, how it will radically change how we design services and experiences. We chat about the complexity of data ownership and build on the conversation threads that myself and Scott Jensen spoke about several months ago. Oliver is awesome, and I know you're going to really, really love this conversation. Now, if you like what we're doing at This Is HCD, you can help us out by doing a few things. You can hit the follow button or the subscribe button wherever you are. It'll mean we stay in touch and you can get notified when a new episode drops. You can leave a review for us or go one better and become a patron on the podcast by going to thisis8cd.com. You can get an ad-free stream for as little as €1.66 per month and you get a shout out as thanks. There's other plans there where you can get exclusive items too, such as a notebook or a t-shirt or a hoodie. And all the money goes towards editing, hosting and maintaining our website, which is a repository for human-centered design goodness with over 250 episodes. Anyway, folks, I've rambled on. Let's jump straight in. Oliver, great to have you in the podcast. Delighted to have you here. But for our listeners, maybe start off with talk a little bit about yourself. Tell us where you're from, what you do. Let's go. Let's talk.
Great. So my current role, let's start with that, and then we can work backwards from there. So currently I'm the Director of Design and Innovation, which sounds very fancy.
Ooh, that's a fancy one.
A UX consultancy based in Sydney called Contextual. And for many years, for the past 13 years, we've been known as Mobile Experience.
Yeah.
And we recently changed our name last year, and we may come back and talk about that in a bit more detail. Yeah. But prior to that, I've now spent, I suppose, over 23 years UX consulting in and around Sydney and working with all the big blue chip companies and corporates here in Australia, right through to startups and advisory roles and so on.
Let's go back to the beginning and talk not even about mobile experience, but the stuff that you did in university. What did you study? Was it in Sydney or was it the Central Coast, you say?
I studied in Newcastle, University of Newcastle.
Yeah.
So a bit north of the Central Coast, a couple of hours north of Sydney. And I initially wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and I wanted to work with people in some form, and psychology seemed to be the right thing, whether I was going to do sports psychology or forensic psychology or clinical psychology, or I wasn't quite sure. So I started out in that path, and I did a four-year undergrad there. And at the end of that, there were options to do clinical or a master's in organizational psychology. And let's face it, I didn't make the cut for the clinical. So I gave the organizational psychology a crack. And as part of that, we did a couple of subjects in HCI as well as a bunch of psychometric testing.
It's fortuitous. So.
Indeed.
Yeah. What clinical lost out on is what we gained.
Yes. well, let's do. But and that sort of really, that those subjects in HCI really were of interest to me. I'd grown up using computers from quite an early age. Both my parents were teachers, but my dad taught computing as well. And he would bring home the Apple IIe's and the Apple IIc's and the SE30 we ended up getting and stuff. So I was using computers and Amstrad's and other things as well. But as a tool to achieve an outcome, not because I was necessarily interested in the code, although, you know, in later years I learned about code to a degree, but it was a tool to help somebody achieve something. And I really liked that way they could enable people to achieve something far greater than without it. So I thought that was really powerful.
At that time, like, it's, and again, I'm not coming at this with ageism, but it was in the 80s. It would have been the Apple II, did you say?
Yes, 100%. Yeah, exactly.
For people listening who might be on the younger end of, you know, the practitioner age, computers way back then didn't have the interfaces that we would know now. So using computers to enable a task wasn't as sexy as it was now. Like, it would have been very much code based. You probably would have been using the literal, the big, large, what are the disks there? Wasn't even a floppy.
Yeah. So yeah, it was command line and so on, especially obviously with the 2E, 2C. And then we started to get to these GUIs, you know, obviously with the Mac and,
the late 80s.
And so on. I think the Lisa just turned 40. I've never seen
that. Wow. So it would have been really kind of evolutionary at that stage to try and leverage what was happening in the computer world and bring it back into the real world. What kind of stuff were you trying way back then?
It was really basic things. And, you know, it was just things like writing essays were so much easier when I didn't have to rewrite the thing because I got a bunch of stuff wrong. It was as dorky as it sounds in primary school, you know, writing my essays on a computer and printing them up so that they looked a lot neater than they did otherwise. And desktop publishing, right? Like that, you know, obviously this was for school, so it wasn't a commercial output, but I could put pictures in there and things that, again, I wasn't trying to do it to prove a point. It just felt like a better medium for me, a more natural or a more efficient and effective medium. Yeah, 100%. So I really enjoyed that about it. And again, I'll keep using this word enabling because I think that's really it. You know,
absolutely. So you went on, you were in your university in Newcastle, you have a psychology background and you worked in a number of practices where you got to apply psychology, I guess, and the design, the mix of the two. And I want to talk a little bit more around the kind of the career arc that's happened, okay? Because around that time in the early 2000s, a lot of the HCI stuff was grounded in the principles of psychology. And I know I came from an industrial design background and I was knocking on the door trying to get in and they're like, no, you don't have a psychology degree. And I remember kind of going, I want to get in, but I can't get in. And then it sort of shifted in the mid 2000s where I was like, okay, actually we need some more of the systems thinking. We need more of the design lens. And I was like, suddenly I had the key then. But it looks like what you're doing now has come back almost full circle. And now we're at that point where we need to understand the psychological understandings of the rationale when we're talking about design and the contextual understanding of these situations. Is that something that you feel now, like the stuff that you did in your past is starting to reemerge almost and have a lot more of a strength to your bow, so to speak?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I've always had throughout the last 23 years a real interest in both the academic side and the pure research side of HCI and aspects of user experience, and have tried to, you know, be involved, whether it's attending CAIR, the Computing User Interaction Global Conference, or Mobile HCI for many years was a global conference academic conference that I enjoyed, and obviously AusCAI here in Australia. Because I think there is so much that adds value, whether it's a research methodology. A lot of these conferences are actually, surprisingly, when I first went along, are more engineer types who are sort of looking at different interface input or output mechanisms and still trying to work out how that might be useful to an end consumer at some point in the future. Things like haptic feedback and so on, you know, academic papers, and now we carry something, you know, something like an Apple Watch that's got haptic feedback, and our phones have haptic feedback. But these have gone through long processes of industrial research or academic research to the point where these things are cost effective to put into a device.
Yeah.
And as that device becomes more complex, the research and sort of background that needs to create those experiences, I think, becomes deeper. And you need to have a deeper understanding of perception, memory, learning once you start combining all these different interface elements, whether it's, you know, speech interaction, looking at different interfaces, like maybe through AR glasses we might talk about later.
Yeah.
And things like that. They're more complex things individually. And when we put them together, they're in, you know, that just it has a network effect of making them significantly more complex. So I think a lot of that tradition, and you see this with the VR and AR headsets, they've come from a long history of investment from DARPA and, you know, those big sort of academic and industrial research facilities that have now led to things like, you know, whether it's the Facebook glasses or whatever, but there's a strong path. And there's still so much money being invested in that side of it, right? It's, we saw that evolution where it went to when we were in the early thousands of it being fairly, you know, desktop based, and we had pretty standard screen sizes, and you knew that people had a keyboard and a mouse and they weren't wandering around with this thing. So the design constraints were much more specific and fixed. And so that allowed more experimentation from an artistic and creative perspective. And now I think as we come back to these very hopefully natural ways of interacting with technology, we need to know more about people and how they want to interact.
The systems have become much more complex as well. You know, the evolution of the user base, we're using an awful lot more technology on our bodies and in our homes and so forth. So naturally the scale and the contextual understanding is going to be much richer and much harder to understand as well. At scale, we've almost created a new wicked problem for us to solve.
Yeah,
in some senses. Going back to the mid 2000s, when you were talking there about the desktop constraints, can you just give us an example of some of those things? Was it Second Life? Is that the kind of stuff that you were talking? Remember Second Life? I don't know if you remember that one.
Yeah, I do. Absolutely. I think ABC, our national broadcaster, had a Second Life environment. There were a lot of people playing around with it. That was it was more experimental. And that spatial, what would have been called a spatial interface back then, of being able to move in a more natural way around a screen and have conversations, you know, avatar-based conversations and things like that. But it's still a 2D experience fundamentally, right? It's not what we sort of talk about in terms of spatial computing, of integrating with the real physical world.
Itself. Sure. So some of the stuff that in the research for this, I know you're heavily involved and you're heavily interested, should I say, in spatial computing. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, imagine you're speaking to somebody who has no experience in this. How would you describe what it is?
Yeah, certainly. Spatial computing to us is this combination of technologies, both inputs and outputs, for human computer interaction. And they can understand the real world, the physicality of the real world. So what's around you? Where are you now? Is there a wall over there? Is there a river over there? So using things like computer vision, etc. And bringing that information and integrating it with digital content. So you might be able to embed a digital element into that real physical environment. And if the wind is blowing at a certain speed, it might sway this digital object in a certain way. Or if noise levels are at a certain thing, it might affect that. Most people have an awareness of something like Pokemon Go, where you've got your mobile device and you're pointing it at the real world, and there's something that looks, it's really overlaid. It doesn't really understand the physicality of the world. It doesn't know that there's a road there and things like that. But that's sort of most people's experience. And a lot of AR, mobile AR experiences are sort of very marketing orientated at the moment and things. And spatial computing is sort of taking that to, and we like to think about it as a future state, and whether that's sort of a couple of years away or 10 years away, where people are wearing glasses, and Doug Bowman at Virginia Tech sort of uses the term everyday AR. So would somebody be walking around with, let's say, a pair of AR glasses, and what sort of things would they want to interact with in terms of digital content?
Yeah.
And we've been doing a lot of thinking about this from a use case perspective, because, again, you know, having spent so long in the mobile industry, 20 years looking at mobile user experience specifically, there's a lot that's happening in the spatial computing space that's very similar. The technology at the moment is very big, it's heavy, battery constrained, field of view is terrible, like what you can actually see looking out of the glasses, the resolution, the brightness, all of those things, just like mobile screens were, you know, 20 years ago, right? But we feel now's the time to start thinking, and there's a lot of investment going into the technology, but how is it going to be used by the person, right? The human. And we believe that time to start researching that, understanding those use cases is now, so that we can start to guide potentially, whether they're operating system level, at an application level, at a service level, what those engagements might be. And also the individual's perspective on that, their levels of trust and safety, given the intimate nature of
because it is very intimate,
like an AR glasses.
It is a very intimate thing. Like the shareability of what you're seeing in your glasses is massively limited. So what you're seeing at the moment, through if you're wearing a pair of glasses, not Google Glass, but whatever, what does that look like in terms of the experience? Because it's very isolated in that sense. Is there any scope around how it could be, you know, shared amongst groups of people? Is that, you know, so I'm thinking of the applications of surgeons when they're operating. Has that been explored a little bit more around the sort of the spatial computing in a shared environment?
Absolutely. So it's interesting you bring up surgery, because Magic Leap 2, which is one of these sort of startups that has had a ton of investment and is sort of more, was going to be sort of consumer orientated as well as enterprise, and they've really doubled down on enterprise. They've just been approved as the first set of AR glasses for use in the surgical environment. I forget which standard it is, So coming back to that shared experience around augmented reality, or spatial computing more broadly, is understanding the observer's position, understanding a combined shared experience, and then also thinking about what we call the bystander experience as well, right? Because how does somebody else be involved if those people are having an experience that is inherently invisible to them? You know, is that via a screen, or are they dialing into a conference call type experience through a 2D screen or whatever that might
Absolutely.
Be?
Absolutely.
It's that consideration and the fact that the beauty is that you can see around you, right? So you can see that somebody's there, as compared to a VR where you're in an immersive experience that you can't see.
It's kind of a see-through experience. But it's also the complexity around the data sharing there, because you can't really interface it unless you're doing something with Blink. So who controls in that sense? Because now we're moving into the spatial computing. So someone is making the decision on the contextual delivery of the information at the right time in the right place. What's the ethical considerations in around that engine?
Yeah, I'll take that from two sides. The first one is that ethical aspect of there are cameras on these devices often, and even if they're not a standard camera, they might be a LiDAR camera. So they can't see who that person is, but they understand that there's a physical person there. They understand you're in an environment, etc. So a lot of that data about the context of use could be, you know, absolutely abused in the wrong hands. So that data ownership over my environment and what these devices can detect and use is a critical piece of this. So how do we trust either the vendor of the hardware or the vendor of the hardware, the vendor of the software, and the vendor of whether it's an application or whatever that might be? We want to be confident. And do we control that in that we allow access or we can delete things from our history or whatever it might be, I think is a critical piece.
And the vendor of the environment as well.
Sorry, I missed that.
The vendor of the environment as well, if there's a contextual understanding at the environmental level. So I'm thinking in prisons, like we start getting into this whole kind of, I don't know, it's a cluster, potentially, like in the nicest possible way, like who, how, and how are they being managed, and how do you see it being managed? And we're not looking for a concrete answer from Oliver. We heard it from Oliver. He said it was going to be government. What does that look like? Because we're starting to move into the conversation, like a segue from Scott Jensen's conversation a number of weeks or months ago. We were talking about how does this how do we start the conversation around these things? Because that's the bit that really, and I am one of those kind of nerds, that's the stuff that I think about when I'm falling asleep. I'm like, who's going to manage that?
Yeah.
What does it look like?
And I think some of the stuff that we're starting to play with and prototype is extrapolating out from some elements of current technology that might be able to do that. And intelligent agents are critical to that. So especially for that understanding of context and putting a combination of contextual information elements together to create an experience. So things like focus modes, like that, you know, Apple have really been focused on with iOS 16 and prior as well. And looking at to what degree can somebody construct their own focus mode to be specific to a context. But these things are complex. And, you know, again, looking back to mobile, it was like how many people are going to go and customize their mobile settings and all that sort of stuff. It takes a lot of effort. So we're expecting that artificial intelligence will play a key role in that, in interacting and guiding the intelligent agent, but that there will probably be a more human role in training that purposefully, or that the intelligent agent is checking in probably at a higher rate of frequency to start with when it's introducing a change in interaction and getting confirmation. And there should be sort of, you know, the opportunity potentially to learn quickly from the system side.
Yeah.
But again, I think we don't want to paint the picture of this thing being in your face all the time. We see it starting out as really maybe something really simple, like one of the use cases that we sort of play with is imagine a reminder service that was physically located, right? So if I'm walking past somewhere that maybe I set a reminder to, hey, when you go past this library, remember to look at this particular book that's held in this library. And I can see from far away, or as I get closer to that library, maybe from 5 kilometers, that there's some sort of visual indicator that there's a reminder there. And I might want to engage with that and go, hey, what is that? Or as I get closer to it, I get this more higher level of detail to go, oh, this is a reminder about the book. The library isn't open yet, but it'll open 15 minutes. How do we make that really succinct and appropriate? Because we don't want to busy the visual field. It needs to be highly relevant and contextual, right? So those aspects of the things we're going, what's the least you can start with that will add value? And I think a lot of the headset stuff is trying to be these big field of view, very rich immersive, like high fidelity things. And I don't think that's necessarily something that's achievable in the short term. And I don't think it's necessary to provide a good experience.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there was a company called Mojo Vision who were working on a contact lens, and one of their key sort of offerings was going to be this opportunity to help people with low vision identify edges of things.
Right? Okay, yeah.
Now that in and of itself is potentially a very powerful use case, and very simply, and unfortunately they've pivoted to look at technology, display technology aspects.
Yeah. But
there's a project ARIA Research in Australia, which is looking at how can somebody wear an augmented reality headset who is blind? And people go, well, if it's a pair of glasses, then they're blind. How does that help? And the face is actually a useful point for detecting information, right? So this headset uses echolocation and enables blind people or low vision people to get an understanding of their environment, right? It happens to be head mounted because that's the orientation position, right? That's most important.
It's crazy. Like as you're talking here, I'm like, I've encountered some of this stuff before. I just remembered I did when I finished uni in 2001. My main project, I called it LEDA, L-E-D-A, which is Latin for finder, I think it was. People who really speak Latin are like, that's not true. But in my mind, I think it was at the time, but it was a little robot that scoured the environment around for visually impaired people to feedback audio and visual context through an in-ear device. And I remember people going, that's never going to happen. And I jumped out of my seat when I saw Google Maps. I was like, oh my God, that's almost what I'm talking about. A car goes around and maps the world and feeds it back in. So what you're talking there is really, it's kind of similar in execution. But I want to ask you, over COVID times, okay, there was a huge pattern and I was one of them, right? Switched off all my notifications. Okay. I was in hyper arousal mode for years and I probably still am. And I've really very carefully and heavily curated the notifications that get shared on my mobile device. So I have the control on what gets displayed on my mobile device. Very if important. It's in the wrong hands, Facebook. And
glad you said.
Yeah. Well, I don't care. Come and get me, Zuck. If it's in the wrong hands, well, what's the worst things that can happen? Because there's two sides of the conversation. One, the user pays and they pay heavily for the service and the device and they manage their data. Or the other side of it is someone like Facebook. They create the devices, they leverage the data, and they sell it on to advertisers. What are the kind of the pros and cons for both there in that sense? Because you need to get mass adoption in order to become normalized. Otherwise, you're going to end up seeing these people walking around cities talking to their glasses, and instantly they're like, they're the ones with the money, let's mug them.
Well, and we saw, you know, variations of this with the glass hole when Google Glass came out, right? And that social element. So I think there's two sides of that. There's the social aspect, which is how am I perceived?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's that element of, well, 20 years ago, if somebody was walking around without a mobile next to their head and talking to themselves, you would have called them insane. But now we're all happily walking around with our AirPods in and no one's blinking an eyelid. So I think there's the socialization of technology and the right timing of that. And that needs to be slow and deliberate from and carefully done to build that trust with that consumer base to make sure that they feel they are in control and that there is the benefit there. Now, you know, you can say that about Facebook because there's lots of people who engage with Facebook and they have the, to what degree have they given up that privacy and to what degree for what benefit? And will that be different with an AR experience? I still expect that there will be a sliding scale. Some people will be more ready to do that. Some people will be a lot less. In my, you know, I come from very much the perspective of data ownership by the individual and data control by the individual. Now, if that individual has the option and decides to monetize some of their information to subsidize a service or whatever, then that could be up to them. But I think these types of technology are inherently so much more personal that it will become, while it might be less visible to people today who are engaging with services like we've mentioned and what they do give up, because it's not there in their face, this will literally be in their face, right?
Yeah.
Nobody wants to see a bunch of ads pop in to their field of view as they're walking down the street. So I think those business models will always have an influence and there will be sliding scales, but I think the emphasis will be on individual control over that data.
How do you see
it? And I think part of our interest in engaging with this area now, knowing that it's not going to be a commercial reality in you know a short period of time, is that we need to start thinking about these things now, because the technology, for better or worse, is happening and there's that investment and people are exploring this stuff. We as designers who want to represent or understand the human condition and represent that and hear that voice in those design processes, whether they're hardware or software, needs to be happening now. And one of the groups is the XR Guild, who you know are really looking at those ethical principles to guide design around these types of technologies.
Have they created a set of principles that are ready to share?
They have,
yeah. Okay. Yes.
So if you go to the xrguild.org, that'll lead you to...
I'll put a link in the show notes for that. And the principles. One of the things that people like to jump on the bandwagon and talk about Google Glass as being like, oh, it was the wrong execution and stuff like that. Well, a lot of the time, people fail to really understand that timing is one of the biggest it's one of the restrictive factors for success of innovative products like this. How far away do you think we are in terms of if something like the Google Glass was released today? I think it would have a greater chance of success.
I agree. And if it was integrated, I think there's a couple of elements. It was really a heads-up sort of type device, heads-up display type device.
Yeah.
It had some understanding, but a lot of it was about notifications and things like that. I think there are things that if you are integrated with the physical environment around you to a greater detail that will offer more value. But I think you could have a similar product that is more deeply integrated with my mobile device and is acting more like a display for my mobile device. Like I leave my mobile in my pocket, similar to, you know, a smartwatch sort of thing, where I'm attending less to the full screen of my mobile and looking at more stuff through glasses. I fully expect it to start with, because of battery and the, you know, not everybody obviously wears glasses. I don't wear glasses all the time, just when I'm reading and things, that people need to adapt to that form factor. And there's some really other interesting form factors in the AR space as well, that there's a company called Humane, who's a couple of ex-Apple alumni who are creating an AR, what's probably going to be a display tech, a laser display tech. So you sort of wear it on your chest potentially, and it will output a display onto your hand or onto a surface near you that you could potentially then interact with, right? And it's using a camera for computer vision input and potentially an intelligent agent for input and conversational UI. But it doesn't necessarily have to be a set of glasses. There's a bunch of really interesting.
So it's not in the realms of, you know, kind of 10, 15 years. You probably think this is going to be sooner?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
So I think within 5 years, we'll see things that are useful to us that we are wearing. It might be in a shorter session duration. It might be something like using for virtual screen use. So maybe I'm a businessman or a businesswoman and I'm at my computer at my desk a lot of the time, but then I want to go on a business trip and I don't want someone looking over my shoulder when I'm in the airplane, but I want a big screen, but I don't want to carry a big screen. So I could just have my device, whether that's my mobile, whether it's a keyboard that I pop in into my bag, and it is the computing power is contained in there, and that I'm using this headset as the display technology. And that's a very sort of standard use case. But I think there's some opportunities there that are sort of low-hanging fruit that will, again, sort of make this a bit more mainstream, not general customer, but be built around those verticals. There's a lot of AR use in industrial settings at the moment with various information and so on. So, yeah, I think it will broaden out. There will be something that is consumer-priced, though not a strong uptake, and over that sort of maybe 5 to 10 year period, that consumer uptake will increase. You know, there's a lot of rumors that Apple will bring out something this year that will probably be quite niche and developer orientated to start with, but the aim is to get the developers on board and creating these whether it's you know, applications or content or experiences of some type. And I think that's the interesting thing. Like, I really think that we'll move away from this app-focused experience or to a more broader engagement across different devices, of which the glasses are part of an output or whatever that might be.
The way I see
constellation of devices.
The constellation of devices. I see it like a recipe thing, and you're adding an ingredient. The app is the ingredient you're adding into your own system, and it adds that extra flavor to it if you want.
Yeah, I'm going out for this particular type of experience.
Yeah.
Do I wear my watch? Do I wear my glasses? Do I take my phone? Like, I'll go out for a walk now and I don't take my phone anymore because I've got my watch and my headphones, right?
Yeah.
If I don't need to take photos, then that doesn't really matter that I don't have my phone.
So all of the stuff that we're speaking about here tends to use a number of factors like environment and so forth. What about the biometric understanding of the contextual understanding of when is the right time based on the mental well-being of the person using it? So the amount of times I use my sort of notifications come through my device and I say two words to it and it begins at F and finishes at off. I'm like, not the right time. I'm obviously rushing to get the kids. My heart rate is up. I'm like, I don't care about this stuff about, you know, an offer for discounted trainers. I'm like, not now. Where's the potential for this? Because like I'm wearing a smartwatch and my biometrics are being read. It's been owned by Google, Fitbit. And when I look at, you know, I spoke to Amy Butcher a number of weeks ago, who CBO at chief behavioral officer, should I say, at Lirio, an American business.
Yeah, I listened to that one.
And it's really really interesting because their business model is around the change of the behavior. And that's massively going to shift the service design capabilities and potential for services. I can see so many empowering pieces that could alter how we design services moving forward. But that biometric, that human aspect, is the bit that I keep on coming back to, like, you know, when and how we go about doing these things. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, by where, and let's go with the glasses for a second, you know, things like understanding where somebody's gaze goes is potentially has huge implications if that data can be accessed by a third party, right?
Yeah.
Or conveyed even to people within that environment potentially. So that privacy element is really critical from our perspective. And again, you want to, I think the onus is on us to design better experiences that people will want to engage with. And again, the notifications, you know, world that we live in at the moment is just too overwhelming. Yeah. And it's not right. And you almost need to reset that and go, okay, what is important enough for me? And that's why I think this sort of focus mode type approach is interesting, because you can whitelist things or you can blacklist things. And, you know, in certain contexts, you can turn some information on and some things off, right? And, you know, part of my passion is design fiction and being able to explore that future state and think through, okay, what could that be? Because
speculative, yeah.
It's not going to be tomorrow, right? We're not going to have an artificial intelligence through an intelligent agent. I mean, we get frustrated enough with the various intelligent agents that we have in our lives that can't really do too much beyond music and timers, right? And not even that very well half the time. So I appreciate that it's far from a solved problem in and of themselves, intelligent agent, speech interaction, IoT, all of those things. But I do believe that we need to start thinking about how that might happen. And one of the frameworks that we came up with was this idea of, you know, instead of just this app-based model, what might an AR sort of layers of experience, we refer to it as, how might that help? And that's things like, there is a notification layer because the notifications are still going to be critical, but that filter on that we expect would be so much stronger, right? Like, don't bother me unless it's a person that is in my close family or a, you know, work colleague or whatever my whitelist says.
Yeah.
And between these hours and my colleagues can't contact me within, or they know I'm in Fiji or Japan or wherever, so don't contact me because I'm not working. Or actually, you can contact me, whatever those
you can
be.
Do some
but
of that.
Those focus modes and constraints and settings, they're complex to set up, but hopefully the idea is
exactly
that the artificial intelligence through the intelligent agent will be able to adapt to that over time. And generative AI, we've got a client who's doing some fascinating work in that space of being able to help individuals within a home who are neurodiverse or have different range of physical impairments via an intelligent agent and adapt to their capabilities and the nuances of their behavior, right? Which only might play out over weeks or months, right? Like,
yeah.
Or seasons even, right? Because they have such a strong influence on our behavior. Something that happens when the sun goes down in summer might be significantly different to the same time in winter.
How are you staying on top of this, not going to say way, I think, but this emerging part of design, like these conversations that we need to be having? I know you used to run a mobile group in Sydney was it Mondays or something? I just remember.
Mobile Monday, yes. Mobile Monday Sydney and also the Mobile Industry Group under the Australian Interactive Media Industry
Association. Spatial computing.
No, was the there's answer. An answer to that. You put me on the spot. I am thinking through that, and I think there's an opportunity to have conversations. And over the last couple of years, we've been communicating with a small group, both locally here in Australia and also globally. Firstly, to listen, to understand who is out there. There are amazing people out there, like Ali Heston from a UX perspective, who worked with Magic Leap and is with Niantic, or until recently with Niantic. There's a lot of thought leaders out there who write amazing stuff, and a lot of that is tracking them, understanding. But we haven't, and we've been sort of keeping that a bit in-house so that we have something sensible to say when we engage in those conversations. But another element of what we're doing is we're doing a lot of that prototyping and thinking through frameworks and all sorts of things in-house just to get us in that mode of thinking for pure research. This is not stuff that we're doing on our UX consultancy day to day. We might go and talk to a big telco or a big retailer about what we're doing because it's interesting, but we're not selling this as a service yet because we're still in that process. And we're doing things like engaging PhD researchers to look out at the academic research that is happening in this field and collate that and draw that back in. Because again, I want us to be founded in HCI and really sort of the use cases be extrapolated through the information and pure research that's happened, and us obviously extend those to prototypes in maybe different fields or whatever, but then do user research as they go out through a different domain or through a different interface type or whatever.
It's kind of amazing because the world of HCI kind of died off a little bit when UX kind of, you know, took over the world. It's almost like HCI is returning in some sense.
Yeah, I think there's a greater appreciation for the importance of rigorous research and research methodology. And, you know, one of the things that I've always, which I love about the UX industry is you can be, the technology, the rate of technology change is exciting and there are exciting things happening. There's certain things that I'm not interested in. I'm not really focused on VR. Somebody might be really excited by that. I'm focused on this particular area of spatial computing, and there's so much changing that it's evolving and we watch it evolve. And with mobile, we saw that. And I think as people who, especially in Australia, I think we have this mindset that these things are designed by global operators and thrust upon us. Yeah. And sometimes we can think at that level, and whether it's designing services, we might be not be designing the OS per se, but we might be designing services, but we can still, it's not a solved problem. We think that these people know the answer and are doing the right thing. And sometimes they haven't had time to do that research or to think through that particular use case or that extrapolation. So yeah, I think it's a fun thing, and that's, you know, obviously I've the luxury of running my own company and being able to play around with stuff and explore this stuff.
One last question for you, and it's one that I'm sure every listener is probably thinking about here. Do you think it'll be T1 or T2 that is going to come back in time?
That side of things, yes. I do not have an opinion on that. No. Hopefully the AR glasses will identify them and remove them with the lasers beaming out from them.
T2 is a little bit funnier, I think.
Well, Jerry, I'm so old that I'll probably be dead by then anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Oliver, people want to reach out to you and ask questions and stuff like that. We could put a link to your business website in there as well for people to follow you, because you're definitely doing some interesting stuff. And there's a great video on your website as well, which understands and outlays spatial computing. But what are the best channels?
We've got a bunch of other videos that in not too distant future will be linked from that website to display some examples of what I've been talking about, prototypes that we're working on, whether they're video prototypes or in headset prototypes to showcase. And of course, Twitter was a thing. I used to be there and both reading and talking, but I've made the move over to Mastodon, but it's not quite I'm enjoying it, but the AR community, interestingly, doesn't seem to have migrated. And I thought they would have been some of the first, or maybe I just can't see them. I'm not sure yet.
Yeah, I'm over there as well. Follow Scott Jensen, though. He's the
yeah, of course.
He's the man who's kind of like directing me on some of the stuff on Mastodon. But we'll put a link to your LinkedIn as well.
Yes, that's LinkedIn. Probably the most beneficial these days.
Yeah, absolutely. But Oliver, listen, like, I finished the episodes with thanking the guests for their openness, their honesty, and their vulnerability as well, and answering a lot of the questions. And hopefully I didn't put you on the spot too much today, but I really, really enjoyed speaking with you, Oliver.
Jerry, it was a true honor. How many are you up to now? Are you nearly at 250?
251, I think it is, 252 on this.
Wow. Like, and thank you, because it's such a valuable resource, and it's so lovely to get all the different perspectives that you gather from around the world. It's really amazing. So really appreciate the work that you do.
Really, really appreciate that coming from yourself. So thanks so much for that.
All the best.
There you go, folks. I hope you enjoyed that episode. And if you enjoyed it and want to listen to more, why not visit thisishcd.com, where you can learn more about what we're up to and also explore our courses whilst you're there. Thanks again for listening.